The Who have been going 10 years, and we're a lot older, and we're looking in different places, and we've still got the same sort of motivations. We still like to dance, we still like to play, we still like kicks, right? But there's that sort of taint, if you like, of having done it all before many times, that makes you start to sort of weigh things up and look at things a little bit differently. And I think this is a feeling that you get from the whole generation, you know, that the Who have got a funny kind of audience. It's not really like the Stones audience, and it's obviously not like the Slade audience or whatever. It's a very sort of strange cross-section of people. Some of them are very, very fervent, been following us for years and years and years and years. Others maybe caught on at the time of Tommy and then started to find out there was more to the group than just that, and that we did have a history and we did have roots. But the Who's roots are very much their own roots, you know, and whereas the Stones and the Beatles had roots in R&B and so forth, we had roots in Goldalt Road and Carpenters Park, Watford. You know, it was funny, but there you go, you know.
And you mentioned also spiritual disenchantment, and you yourself...
Desperation.
You yourself have what followed Mayor Barber.
Well, my position is a lot different to the average kid, you know. I mean, I suppose I never really went through this thing of sort of being spiritually desperate. Or maybe I did, but didn't realise it. This is really what I'm trying to get at in this thing, is that there's a whole lot more than meets the eye to the sort of turning over of a generation like ours. I mean, I think it's particularly notable the way rock music has... And the things that it's done, and the things that it's effected, and the changing lifestyles and the changing philosophies right from the ground right the way up. I mean, I even look at things like women's liberation as being like that lost in the middle of Watergate and Vietnam and Mr. Heath arguing with Joe Grimmond or whatever his name is now, Jeremy Thorpe. There are individuals there that not only are worried about their pay structure or things like this, but are worried about something else which they can't put their finger on. You know what I mean? And I think rock music gets a bit like that. You get these people that can knock out about four chords and they say, well, yeah, music's just for dancing, man, you know. Of course it is. But there are individuals out there as well, you know. And
But what made you sort of follow Mayor Barber? Was it because all you'd experienced, because you had been through pill popping and all that, presumably?
I'd had an incredible time, obviously. I mean, this is going to sound like very, very, very decadent, but I mean, what actually led me to get sort of spiritually insecure, desperate, if you like, was everything going too well, if you like. It was running out of ambition, running out of roads that I wanted to, or mountains to climb, if you like. It sounds romantic, but that was really what buggered me up, is that I get to the grand old age of about 25 and I'd done everything that I'd ever wanted to do. And I thought, well, what is there now to do? What am I here for? You know, why have I been born? You know, if everything comes so easy, what do I do? Just look at something and then all of a sudden it's mine. So I thought I'd go for the absolute biggest target I could ever go for, which was to, you know, presumably to find God or to find myself, whichever way you look at it. And as soon as I started thinking in those terms, as soon as you start looking for a genuine master, one arrives, you know, because his ears are constantly pricked up.
But was there a crisis, a personal crisis, no, that led you to that, or was it a gradual process?
No, that was the crisis, was running. I mean, it was a very sudden thing. It happened, I think, immediately after Monterey. I knew after Monterey that we'd finally cracked America. I knew that we were going to be big in the States after that. I just knew. I knew Jimi Hendrix was going to be fairly big, but I somehow also knew that something was going to happen. I don't know how, I just knew that he wasn't going to be there for very long. I didn't think he was going to die, obviously. And I also tried what I suppose is the most powerful drug available, or was at the time anyway, not a narcotic, but a psychedelic drug, which was called STP. And, I mean, after that, I just thought, well, what is there to do? You know, I mean, you can literally sort of take your mind apart and chuck it in the filth and then pick it up and put it back in your body again. And then where are you? Where have you been? What have you done? What have you got to, you know? And so I stopped. First thing that happened is I stopped using psychedelic drugs. I carried on smoking dope for a long time, pot and stuff. I mean, musicians do, don't they? I mean, it's like, you know, gin and tonic. And eventually, later on, when I got into Barbara, I didn't really find the need for that anymore, you know. I can take it or leave it. The point is that for somebody, what I must explain, is there's a great difference between somebody that is looking, right, and somebody that is questioning, right, and it, because they will automatically get an answer. If you're really spiritually desperate and you really are screwed up, right, spiritually, you'll get help. Now, this doesn't apply on any other facet of human life. If you've lost a leg to a tiger in the jungle in Bengal, God doesn't come out in a shiny white suit and come to help you. That's because, you know, it's your chosen situation, and he's in there anyway, if only you knew. But when you start to question who you are and what you are, and it starts to make it impossible for you to continue living, then you do get help. I don't know how or where it comes from, but you get help, and you end up usually either with a genuine master or with some particularly helpful situation that might work out. I mean, things change differently for different people. Every person is a different path, you know. But Maya Barber didn't come into my life like an explosion and turn everything upside down. I mean, he wasn't the kind of sensational Godhead figure that somebody like Guru Maharaj is at the moment. He, in fact, on the surface, was a very quiet and sort of unsensational figure. Never spoke, kept silence as a kind of a symbolic self-discipline for 46 years. And spent really most of his time preening and working with a select group of people, maybe, I don't know, maybe 200 or 300 people that lived around him, working with them as sort of people that I suppose are the spearhead of humanity. I mean, I went to India and met a lot of Barber's disciples, people that had lived with him all their lives, you know, and they're fantastic people, and there's no doubt about it that they're very, very spiritually advanced, whatever that means. You know, but you can tell there's a part of the human equipment which is there to know whether or not you should tip your cap or push somebody out the way. Well, you don't push any of those people out the way. Not even if you're Adolf Hitler, you don't, you know. You approach with caution because there's something about them. There's an aura about them, and there's a power about them. And there's an age about them. You know, you can see in their eyes what they've been through. They might be very young. They might be a 17-year-old person, but you can see in their eyes what they've been through. It was Maya Barber's attention to detail, perhaps, that made me end up with him. Somebody that followed him for many years over here called Delia De Leon, I'd met Mike McKinney, who ended up doing the Tommy album cover for us. She knew Mike. And if you remember the Observer colour supplement article, do you remember that? With us on the front and me and the Union Jack.
And your Union Jack.
Well, she sent that to Barber. And he apparently took it, and this is just by somebody that happened to be there, took it and put his thumb on my nose, cursed object that it is, and gave it back, and that was it. And it roughly coincides with the day that I started to follow him, and I still follow him very, very closely today. I'm not really impressed with any of the other masters that I've seen, and I still really feel an incredibly strong tie between Jesus Christ and Maya Barber and other great masters, and I feel that Barber is what he says he was, which is the Messiah, as against being a perfect master. I really do feel he was somebody very, very, very special.
We're usually open on Tommy, but today we'll close on Tommy, because the film is now going to be made. I think he's going to direct it. Will the Who be in it, or will the part of Pete Townsend be played by Richard Harris?
Well, the way Ken's done the script is that the two really biggest parts in it are the mother and Uncle Ernie. Tommy himself is going to be played by Roger, so that's Tommy out of the way. I think after hearing Roger's performances on the Lou Reisner version of Tommy, I think that with new Who backing tracks and yet another chance for Roger to have a stab at it, I think it should be the vocal performance of Roger's career, actually, because he really does get behind the vocal on that. And of course, we played the thing on the stage a million times, and he can just close his eyes and sing it really from somewhere deep inside. I think it really will be incredible. Ken Russell and Roger both seem quite confident about Roger's ability to act out the part. The mother is pretty difficult. We're thinking about all kinds of people at the moment, but she is a big part, you know. Uncle Ernie, we thought maybe we'd ask Keith Moon to do that, as he's become a...
I thought he'd ask himself.
...current film star. He might have to be persuaded, because he seems to be... we might pay him a bit over the odds now. There's several starring roles to his credit. John and I ain't in it at all. I mean, we appear in one scene as part of a band. I mean, I don't really ever want to act. I don't really feel natural doing it. I've actually tried it before in various films and things that have been made, because I like to make films myself, and I've often tried acting in them and been involved with people that have done it, and it's not really a natural thing for me. For one thing, I can't remember... Not only can I not remember scripts...
Yeah, I remember at the Rainbow, you holding your own lyrics.
I can't even remember something that I've written, right? So yeah. It's just... It's my concentration is very, very poor. And that means that if I do sort of, like, plunge myself into a character, the only thing I'm really good at is being myself. Really what I'm interested in, believe it or not, having said that I would never, ever, ever touch the music of Tommy again, is I'm quite looking forward to the idea of reorchestrating it and redoing it with The Who. I think it might, because we'll be able to do it in a couple of weeks, because it's like really sort of second nature to us now, we'll be able to do it very quickly, and I'm really looking forward to sort of restructuring it and seeing if I can improve on the original.
Yeah, because about 2 years ago you were adamant that you were never going to play it again. I think now we might even have Tommy on Ice and the novel of the film.
Well, God forbid. What I'd really like to see happen is for The Who to be again in command rather than the other way around. I think with our new album we will be. You know, that sort of thing usually only happens once in a lifetime to a rock group. I mean, it happened to the Beatles with Sgt. Pepper and... You know, I mean, there have been... It's happened to everybody, I suppose, in a way, but... it's not something that we try to live down anymore. I mean, it's something... We've given up the struggle and we just float along with it, you know. People, air hostesses still say, which one's Tommy? And, you know, we just... We laugh today at that appalling remark in the same way that we laugh if somebody comes up and says, ooh? Who, which, what? You know, we all go, yeah, good one. Never heard that joke before. The first thing that happened is that I heard from Bob Pridden, who's our road manager, that Eric Clapton was living near him in a nearby town. They live in Surrey, both of them, within about, I suppose, an 8-mile drive. And that Bob often used to go down and see him and sort of admire his collection of Ferraris. And I hadn't seen Eric for probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, not since we mutually attended a series of Jimi Hendrix concerts. I'd seen him on and off after that a couple of times in the States, but as you probably know, Eric did go into a kind of a seclusion, and I think there was only certain select friends that saw him after the demise of Derek and the Dominoes. I didn't see him at all. And I heard that he'd had a home studio built, in his house. Well, this is one of my pet fascinations. In fact, I formed a company to build home studios, which fortunately went bankrupt. The main reason I went down there firstly was to see his studio and to renew an old friendship. And when I got down there, what I found really was Eric and a studio, a house, a series of cars, his missus, and a pile of unfinished tapes, which I think had been started the last time that I'd seen him, which was about a year previous in Olympic Studios when we were recording the Who's Next album. He was doing mix downs. And apparently this was like the shell of his next album. And I thought I could help out by helping him finish off the tapes in his studio and so on and so forth. And that's really how it all started. I was going to finish off the production of the Derek and the Dominoes' last album, which, incidentally, the tapes are still there. I mean, some of them are very, very good, and hopefully one day that will get finished. But Eric was a bit rusty, and it took a lot of effort and work to sort of get him interested, re-interested in something which was a year and a half old practically by that time. And all the work that I and Bobby were putting in did seem to be sort of going down a drain somewhere. Eric wasn't really reacting at all to sort of the idea of getting the album finished, although he knew that it was somehow necessary. And then one day I got this very strange phone call, which was from Alice, who's Eric's lady, and rang up and said, Eric's really keen to do a gig at the Rainbow as part of this Fanfare for Europe thing. And I didn't know quite then how it came about, but apparently Great Western are connected with Alice's father and stuff like this. And that's how the original offer was made. And of course I jumped at it. I thought, well, fantastic, if Eric wants to do a gig, that's obviously the thing that's really going to brush the cobwebs off, as we always say. And rushed down and we talked it over, and sure enough he was very keen to work and do this show, which was only, I suppose, about 4 weeks away. So we had a deadline and we had 4 weeks in which to rustle up musicians, and we phoned all around the world trying to get people together. And in the end we ended up with the band with, as most people probably know by now, it was Stevie Winwood, Jim Capaldi, Jimmy Carstein on drums, myself, Ronnie Wood on guitars, and Reebok, who showed up on the day, played congas. And it turned out to be, probably to my amazement, it turned out to be a fantastic band, because we did very intensive rehearsals. We worked at Ronnie Wood's house, and we worked very intensively on getting the act into shape. Eric turned up on time every day for 2 weeks and everybody, when initially approached, Stevie immediately agreed to do it. Jimmy Capaldi was there almost by proxy. Jimmy Carstein was passing through with the Crickets, doing some work with them when they were recording, and Rick Gretsch brought them down, and he wasn't even intending to be the bass player. Picked up a bass one day and started playing, and was just used right the way through. I mean, a lot of things happen like that. Jimmy Carstein came in and played through a few numbers, and I said to him one day, I said, I better give you the details of the gig. So he said, what gig, man? So I said, this show at the Rainbow. He said, what show? So I said, well, didn't you realise we'd been rehearsing? So he said, no, man, I thought we were just jamming. So we end up with a sort of a band that came together almost sort of by magnetism. And the track that I'd pick first as my first choice was one which I think was probably the most exciting to play. Ronnie Wood's got this fantastic house in Richmond, and the room that we rehearsed in was oval, and the sound used to sort of reflect off the walls, much in the way it would do in St Paul's Cathedral. And this track had something about it when we rehearsed it the first time. We just knew it was going to be incredible. It sort of got certain Steve Cropper aspects to it. The guy out of Booker T, and it's got, I think, certain un-BBC like reflections in the words. If you listen very closely to the words, you might think they're a little bit rude. I don't know. I do. It's called Roll It Over, and I don't think it'll ever sound quite as good as it did in that room in Ronnie Wood's house, but I think this comes near it. The other track that means a fantastic amount to me, which we did at the show, is Little Wing. And the reason for that is because I suppose the time that I felt really closest to Eric was when we were sort of mutually overshadowed in our respective roles as British guitarists by the late, great Jimi Hendrix. Eric rang me up one day and asked me if I wanted to go to the pictures. We went to see a film called Pierrot Le Fou, and after that we went to a club and started our 2-week stint of following Jimi Hendrix around. We went to see him that day, and we went to see him again and again and again and again. And it was rather peculiar sort of situation. It was rather sort of spooky in a way. There was this man on the stage there playing, I suppose, musically everything that Eric had ever wanted to hear himself play. And there was me watching him do everything that I'd ever wanted to do theatrically. And the combination was like almost like we were watching a sort of a fusion of some sort, you know. And of course, you know, Jimmy's very special, something which only he had. And this is an incredible, incredible song. I think it's like probably one of the fieriest that Jimmy ever wrote. And it really gave me great pleasure to sort of announce it at the Rainbow, a Jimi Hendrix song. Little Wing, that's really good buzz. I think people like Eric, and I've heard a lot of people say the same thing about Stevie Wonder, maybe even Jimi Hendrix, they have a certain sort of charisma about them which affects other musicians very deeply and makes other musicians feel I don't know, somehow it sounds a bit like a platitude, but sort of united in a greater cause. I mean, you can pick up on... I mean, I don't pick up and play a guitar because I believe in guitar that much, or because I'm a soulful musician. I mean, my reasons are usually bounced off other reasons, like I write or I'm part of The Who, or, you know, it's 10 years ago since I first decided to do what I do. I just can't remember why I first picked up the guitar. But Eric plays for old-fashioned reasons. He plays because music is his life and guitar is his life. And much the same as somebody... I mean, there is no other Eric Clapton, obviously, but he does have a very simple approach, I suppose that's what it is that if you look at somebody like The Who, it's fantastically complicated, the way we go about things. There are four very strong individuals involved, and every step is a complicated one. Every step is a cooperative decision, and very heavy management involvement, and very creative sort of decisions made all the way down the line, even from contract structure right the way down to sort of chord structure. And Eric's life seems to be much simpler. It's got to do with playing the guitar, you know, and that seems to be it. And when you're sort of thrown in with somebody like this, and particularly somebody that you respect, you tend to sort of adopt their outlook on music, and it leaks in and it sort of becomes very infectious. And I think everybody that played on that gig at the Rainbow felt this sort of part of Eric leak in, you know. Everybody felt this sort of like simple approach, that it was really just the music that counted, and that's why you can collect a group, a motley crew, I mean, a fairly unmatched people in essence, you know, to and put them together. And that's why, musically, it worked so well, was the fact that the approach was very, very, very simple. I mean, there were some times at rehearsals when Eric had come up with a number and he'd play us like the Derek and the Dominoes live album and say, listen, I want you to play this track there. I'd say, sounds a bit hard to me. So he'd say, what's the problem? So I said, well, that sort of chord structure, man, I just can't get into that sort of chord structure. And he'd just say to me quite simply, why not? And I mean, it was like one of those statements that there's no reply to, and you think, okay, I'll play the bloody thing. And the reason I started off this spiel is that I was going to introduce the next number, which was Pearly Queen, with a little story. Is that Pearly Queen is the only number that on the stage that Jimmy really played the drums on. I mean, you've probably all heard the stories about Traffic and the fact that Jim won't play the drums anymore. Well, nobody knows why. I'm sure least of all he does. He bangs a tambourine and he sings and he's all good vibes and everything. I think he's a fantastic drummer. And the job Jimmy Carstein did was pretty amazing in the circumstances, but if I'd have had my way, I would have had Jimmy Capaldi play all the way through, because like there's a certain fire to the way he plays the drums, and he leads, and maybe that's why he didn't want to be the lead drummer, as it were, at that gig, because he is a very sort of powerful personality and he tends to sort of lose himself occasionally. But on Pearly Queen you can hear his drumming, like almost like a drum solo, with everybody dithering about in the background on this track, wondering what to play behind him. And because there were two drummers at this particular time, there was Jimmy Carstein desperately trying to catch up in the background, Steve Winwood singing, because it's a Traffic song, in fact.